B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Wednesday, December 14th, 2016. We're going to climb into the Wayback Machine as we open the podcast today. And we're going to take you way back to 1938, when radio was the only electronic medium. And the actor Orson Welles, with his Mercury Theater, staged one of the most infamous broadcasts in American history. It was called the War of the Worlds, and it was a hoax.
Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
Orson Welles was not related to H.G. Wells, but his dramatization of that novel scared the shit out of a lot of Americans. Maybe you've seen the contemporary films that have been made of that broadcast. And it's the War of the Worlds that I feel like we are facing today. A hoax. A very well-crafted and beautifully staged deception of the American people. And I know that evidence is mounting. The media is just turning up the volume. But I'm still demanding proof, friends, and I will continue to do so. Exhibit A is a lengthy piece. I printed it out, 25 pages from today's New York Times. Byline, some great writers. David Sanger, Eric Lipton, Scott Shane, who's been a guest on this program. The headline reads, "The Perfect Weapon, How Russian Cyberpower Invaded the U.S. And while this lengthy piece adds new details and it provides a timeline, it shows that at the Democratic National Committee, the kid, I don't know really how young he was, but a junior staffer who was in charge of their security and web operations, got phone calls from an FBI agent and didn't return them because he didn't really know what to do and he didn't know for sure that the FBI agent was real. And so months went by, and this was an unaddressed vulnerability. And I'm going to recap for you the facts, the information recited in the New York Times article to some extent. I've linked to it in the show file so that you can breeze through it yourselves. But the bottom line here is that Russia is flatly accused of being the culpable party. Here's the second paragraph. At least one computer system belonging to the DNC had been compromised by hackers. Federal investigators had named the Dukes, a cyber espionage team linked to the Russian government. So this is a series of assertions and innuendos, all of them based on the premise that Russia is responsible and that Fancy Bear and Fuzzy Bear, or whoever else these people have been called, are the real culprits. The article never references the substantial claims that this is a leak and not a hack. And it piles up a lot of, like I say, information, but no new evidence from the anonymous government sources that have been leaking to the Washington Post and the New York Times. So, in recapping what happened, here's another quote here. The burglary was conducted from afar, directed by the Kremlin, with spear phishing emails and zeros and ones. There is no citation for that reference to the Kremlin. Next paragraph. An examination by the Times of the Russian operation, based on interviews with dozens of players, intelligence officials, and Obama administration officials, reveals a series of mixed signals. There is no person cited. There is no source. There is no evidence included there. So what we have is one assertion piled on top of another. A couple of paragraphs down, the low-key approach of the FBI meant that Russian hackers could roam freely through the committee's network for nearly 7 months. Now, let me stipulate that this could be true. But our government has provided zero proof, and our media is going into a very, very dangerous extension. And what comes to mind here, and this is just off the top of my bald head, do you know what the law of cantilever is? If you're building a deck that extends out from the side of your house, and it doesn't have any posts to support it, engineers will tell you that the beam that goes into the house and that extends out to support that deck has to be twice as long as the extension from the side of the house to the end of the deck. You get me? Well, this is a deck that doesn't have any cantilever support. It is just lashed on to the side of the house. And it could easily fall away. Now, there could be further evidence that surfaces that will buttress this, that will provide the cantilever support that I believe is missing today. But this lengthy piece from the New York Times is interesting. It's well written. It has a lot of history. But it does not add a scintilla of evidence to these claims that Russia is responsible for what is called a hack. And, as you know, I am still captive to the experts who I have cited on this. Bill Binney, the former technical director of the NSA, and others who have said, look, this is the clear work of an insider who leaked this information because they were angry at the way the DNC treated Bernie Sanders, for example. That's speculation, but that's an obvious potential motive for an insider to do that. We're also getting this cute little tidbit of a story that a Clinton campaign aide named Charles Delavan saw the phishing email that came into John Podesta's Gmail account. And he said that he meant to write, "This is not a legitimate email." But what he actually wrote was, "This is a legitimate email. John needs to change his password immediately." And so we're hearing that this is the click that led to the vulnerabilities that permitted the Russian hackers to get in. And I don't get how, you know, the play on legitimate versus illegitimate, how that jibes with the second sentence here, John needs to change his password immediately. Now, I've received these kinds of emails. And there are times when you scratch your head and say, wow, you know, is that really my bank? But in this case, this mistake by the staffer seems to be somebody falling on a sword. And I don't know if it's warranted or gratuitous. So as we look at this, and I'm leafing through this New York Times story looking for a few more quotes to pull, they cite the espionage by Russia that I believe produced the intercepted phone call between Victoria Nuland and one of her colleagues during the revolution in Ukraine. And I believe that it was Moscow that was able to intercept that call and release the recording of it. How does that prove that Cozy Bear or Fancy Bear or any other bear was involved in the antics of 2016? And they look at some of the clues. One of the files was written in Cyrillic, the Russian alphabet. There was a reference to the guy who founded the KGB. And these are details that either were the result of sloppy cyber espionage or they were intentional breadcrumbs left behind to divert your attention from the actual actors. And so the only real quoted evidence in this New York Times story is from one of the firms that was retained by the DNC to investigate this. CrowdStrike is one of those companies. And we don't know that they have access to any of the intelligence community information that would actually support these assertions. And so what we have is claims made by the government without any proof that are then buttressed by information from the private sector that doesn't intersect with the sourcing of the alleged intelligence assessment. And as to the diversion to WikiLeaks, this is treated just as a matter of fact based on comments that were made online by Guccifer 2.0. And there certainly are some questions that arise from this outlay of the information available. But as I say, it doesn't amount to any kind of evidence or proof. And I think that we have to continue to remain skeptical. And I understand it's difficult in the avalanche of information. Rachel Maddow, she completely believes this stuff. Everyone has bought into it, hook, line, and sinker. And the New York Times has a second article saying that some of the same hacks produced information that was used nefariously to defeat Democrats running for Congress this year, including in Florida, Ohio, and North Carolina, New Mexico, Illinois, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania. Once again, without proving anything, it claims the this was due in part to a de facto alliance that was formed between the Russian hackers and political bloggers and newspapers across the United States. Now, there's one other interesting aspect to this, and that is that, you know, we have this huge intelligence community. There's 17 separate agencies, and after 9/11, they created this uber agency called the Director of National Intelligence. And James Clapper, the proven perjurer, remains for a few more weeks the head of DNI. And his office is not willing to embrace the CIA assessment that Russian cyber attacks were aimed at helping elect Donald Trump. While the Office of the Director of National Intelligence doesn't dispute the CIA's analysis, it has not endorsed their assessment because of a lack of conclusive evidence. Yeah. So, I'm in strange bedfellows. Yesterday, I was complaining that, I'm in agreement with Trump. Now I'm in agreement with James Clapper. And it feels like the war of the worlds, that everybody believes what they hear or see on TV and in the media. Nobody needs to ask any other questions or look for proof or remain skeptical. And Sam Biddle over at The Intercept has done a good job of leafing through, poring over all of these claims, and I've linked to it so you can read it in your leisure time. And Biddle writes, "It certainly remains plausible that Russians hacked the DNC, and it remains possible that Russia itself ordered it. But the refrain of Russian attribution has been repeated so regularly and emphatically that it's become easy to forget that no one has ever truly proven the claim." And he goes into great detail here, not as excruciating as the detail in the Times article. But he says all the evidence comes from either private security firms or independent researchers or official leakers in the government. And he points out factually that metadata in a file leaked by Guccifer 2.0 shows that it was modified by a user in Cyrillic. And the username is Felix Edmundovich, a reference to the founder of a Soviet-era secret police force. So, again, this could be sloppy work. Although the CrowdStrike people praise the work of the Russian hackers, say that they are really professional and very good at it, and then they would leave evidence like this behind? And what about the hacking tools that the NSA claims, was embarrassed by back in July and August? So what this boils down to is that the U.S. is on the verge of launching a cyber attack on Russia based on what I've just described as a mountain of assertions and zero public evidence. This is fascinating, and it is Orwellian and Orson Wellesian. Today I'm releasing an in-depth interview with Jason Leopold, the investigative reporter for Vice News. He comments on the claims about Russian hacking. He doesn't buy it. He's still looking for evidence. But that wasn't the central focus of our conversation. Jason is just back from Guantanamo and comments on the fact that the prison will not be closed. He does speculate that as many as a dozen more prisoners may be released before January 20th, and that we are going to be stuck with the prison remaining open. He also had some sharp comments on the decision by the Obama administration to hold on to the Senate's CIA torture review that was completed about 2 years ago. And they're going to keep it under lock and key at the Obama Presidential Library for at least another 12 years, which is a really shameful development. Here's a comment from Jason Leopold on that issue.
Why are we talking about this 2 years after a pretty scathing executive summary about the program was released? Well, it's because we have seen a culture of impunity over the past 8 years where no one is held accountable. So it's okay to continue to talk about it. Obama said we, quote, tortured some folks. There was a decision early on by the White House not to prosecute anyone, decisions that normally would be made by an attorney general. So there's criticisms now about Donald Trump saying that he won't prosecute or investigate Hillary Clinton, or he won't allow it. And so you have some of the Obama officials saying, hey, he's not supposed to say that. Well, these guys said the same exact thing when they came into office about the Bush folks. I mean, it just goes back and forth, depending on who's sitting, or who is seated, who's in power. And so the issues revolving around torture, and it really is amazing to me, by the way, that we're talking about it again, and that it's actually something that could be reintroduced. Really, if you allow the culture of impunity to exist and go on where there's no accountability, of course that's going to be the case. There's no deterrent. If you go out there in society and I guess commit what would appear to be crimes and not be held accountable for it, I suppose you can continue doing that because there's no punishment.
You can hear the full interview with Jason Leopold. It is released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. At TuneIn, iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, all of our outlets. And my work is made possible by generous people like Terry Paris, Cheryl Fleming, Faith Peoples, and Mark Brodsky. They are subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast, and take the hint, it's time for you to sign up too. I can arrange a gift subscription for a friend or a relative if you'd like that for the holidays. But in any event, come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, it takes you to the sign-up page, and in a couple of minutes, you can set up your own subscription here at peterbcollins.com. Jason Leopold, also busy in the courts. Vice News and their attorney have filed a new lawsuit against the FBI demanding the release of records related to the actions of this year, including the investigation of the Hillary Clinton email scandal, the commentary that was made by the FBI director in July and twice in October. Did the FBI violate federal law by using its authority to influence the election? They want information on all leaks of information by the FBI to the media about the Clinton investigations. They also want FBI communications with Breitbart News and the Trump campaign. So it's a very interesting set of issues. And at the same time, a separate case is moving forward in New York City, where a federal judge in Manhattan is apparently ready to unseal the government search warrant and supporting documents stemming from the FBI's investigation of Anthony Weiner's laptop. Not his lap, just his laptop. And we know his wife, Huma Abedin, the major staffer to Hillary Clinton, had shared that computer, and there were issues. And by the way, on Netflix, I watched that Weiner documentary, the fly-on-the-wall film that was made while he was running for mayor of New York and when his second, or was it his third, sexting scandal surfaced. and it's just really weird. It makes your skin crawl, but it's worth seeing just to see the self-inflicted demise of Anthony Weiner. Anyway, Judge Kevin Castle of Federal District Court ordered the Justice Department to file with him under seal by tomorrow a copy of any search warrant, application, and related documents. Meanwhile, here in San Francisco, it's mostly a secret, but on Monday, there were some arguments held before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Two judges impaneled, hearing testimony in the case of Saleh versus Bush. This is a war crimes trial against George W. Bush, and it garners zero coverage in American media. I did a Google search just before I sat down here. I found that one diary keeper at Daily Kos has written about this, and the Russian news service Sputnik covered the oral arguments on Monday. I did not find a single mainstream American media organization that even had a footnote about this hearing or even a story on its website. And I don't have any great expectation that this trial will lead to a conviction of Bush at all. But I think it's a very important statement, and it shows up the failure of the Barack Obama administration to pursue war crimes investigations and prosecutions. And the torture report that I mentioned a moment ago is a central piece of evidence in any pursuit of justice against Bush and his cronies. And that will not be available for at least 12 years. In Ohio, where I grew up, John Kasich, the governor, did one thing right. He vetoed the so-called fetal heartbeat abortion ban. Clearly unconstitutional, even John Kasich, who panders to the Christian right and the Catholic anti-abortion crowd, even he knew that it was flatly unconstitutional. So he turned around and signed a bill that's still unconstitutional, but not as blatant as the fetal heartbeat bill. It is a ban on abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy, and it makes no exception for cases involving rape or incest, just a single exception for something that poses a serious risk of substantial and irreversible impairment of a major bodily function of the mother in this case. So it's sad to see this occur. They clearly are gearing up to find a case to bring to the Trump-infected Supreme Court, where he has promised to put a pro-life justice up for nomination. And we'll see how that fares and if the Democrats are able to stop such a nominee. The Obama administration, in a last gasp, issued a final rule today to bar states from withholding federal family planning funds from Planned Parenthood and its affiliates. This should have happened long ago. The Democrats have been so flat-footed in responding to these scurrilous attacks on Planned Parenthood. And this is a good move. It's been in the works since September, and they had expected this to be part of the fundamentals for a Hillary Clinton administration. But now they have to try to limit the damage that Trump could do. And while in general this is based on a presidential order that could easily be reversed by Trump, the rulemaking is complicated, and it's based on Title X family planning money, and it's not clear that Trump could just overturn it with the stroke of a pen. So I do appreciate what the administration has done here, but it is a little and a lot late. There was an interesting report issued after 6 years of study by the Environmental Protection Agency yesterday, trying to determine if fracking causes poisoned groundwater. Does it infect the drinking water in nearby areas? And the interesting angle here is I'm looking at two different reports, and I've linked to both of them for your perusal. It's in the show file for today's podcast. First up, Kevin Gostola at Shadowproof, headline, EPA study on fracking vindicates environmental groups. And in the body of the story, he writes, the study affirms the scientific reality that fracking contaminates water, and remarkably, the report appears to be mostly free of fossil fuel industry influence that was apparent in an earlier draft of the study. Greenpeace spokesperson, quote, the report only confirms what too many Americans know from personal experience. Fracking poisons our water, sickens our communities, and there are a couple of other quotes. And then Gostola goes to the American Petroleum Institute, and they blasted the study, accused the EPA of abandoning science. A stark admission, says Gostola, that in the end, the industry failed to unduly influence the final version of the study. And a couple of more quotes from Gostola. In the executive summary, the EPA acknowledges that contamination is possible at essentially all stages of the process. Spills can occur during the management of hydraulic fracturing fluids and chemicals, or produced water that result in large volumes or concentrations of chemicals reaching groundwater resources. All right. So fair enough. That's the pro-environmental take on this news. Then you go to the Associated Press. Story byline by Matthew Daly in Washington, D.C. The headline reads, EPA fracking report offers few answers on drinking water. Opening paragraph. Is hydraulic fracturing, better known as fracking, safe, as the oil and gas industry claims? Or does the controversial drilling technique that has spurred a domestic energy boom contaminate drinking water, as environmental groups and other critics charge? After 6 years and more than $29 million, the EPA says it doesn't know. A new report issued Tuesday said fracking poses a risk to drinking water in some circumstances, but a lack of information precludes a definitive statement on how severe the risk is. One more quote. The report removes a finding of a draft issued last year indicating that fracking has not caused widespread systemic harm to drinking water in the U.S. Industry groups hailed the draft EPA study as proof that fracking is safe, while environmentalists seized on the report's identification of cases where fracking-related activities polluted drinking water. So, this is interesting because the AP is attempting to strike a balance. They're trying to write a story that can pass muster with the Sierra Club and with the American Petroleum Institute. And in doing so, they dilute the information so badly that it leaves the reader saying, oh, well, nothing happened. Move along. Let's go to the comics. Wonder what the Kardashians are up to today. As the Syrian government claims victory in Aleppo, a city that has been flattened and is now virtually deserted, the Islamic State counterattacked in the ancient city of Palmyra, which is kind of in the center of Syria. And there is a new report that says that chemical weapons were used, and this is not a barrel bomb with, chlorine detergent in it, but at least 93 people were killed by a gas attack in central Syria when airstrikes hit a cluster of five villages. Now, this report, which is from the Guardian newspaper based in London, does not indicate whose airplanes may have dropped the chemical weapons. Up to 300 people were also reported to have been injured in the strikes Monday morning. A local regional council member said most of the dead were families. They had built primitive shelters, ran to them. While they were in the shelters, the gas entered because of the wind direction and killed dozens, mostly women and children. Now, the international agency that investigated the claims that Syria had destroyed all of its chemical weapons stockpiles, including sarin, says that they were able to account for 94% of the Assad government's stockpiles. So this does appear to be a credible report. What we don't know is who is responsible. Across the bay from me, the city of Oakland continues to grieve after 36 people were killed in that fire at the Ghost Ship warehouse where an electronica rave party was underway. And yesterday, responding to the latest extortion attempt by the NFL Oakland Raiders, local government officials agreed to pay an extortion of $350 million. They're going to cough up land in Oakland valued about $150 million and spend $200 million on infrastructure, roads, lighting, and other accessories for an expanded stadium to keep the Oakland Raiders here so that they don't run away to Las Vegas as they have threatened. Now, last time the Raiders ran away to Los Angeles, and then they extorted Oakland again when they moved back. There is still $91 million in outstanding debt from the last ransom payment that the city of Oakland paid to the Raiders to get them to come back. Now, they actually have a decent team this year for a change, but that doesn't really change my calculation. The city of Oakland can't afford enough fire inspectors to make sure that there isn't another repeat of the tragedy at the Ghost Ship. But they can fork over $350 million to keep the Oakland Raiders? I have a very hard time with that. And finally, I don't usually talk about personal issues or go below the belt, but I couldn't resist this story because it appears that many people today trim or shave their pubic hair because I guess we're all porn stars now and we have to be prepared for the camera shot. But there is a new study out that shows that adults who wax, shave, or pluck their pubic hair are twice as likely to get an infection. Now, one of the theories is that because of cuts from shaving, for example, you are more vulnerable to pick up a sexually transmitted disease. And the statistics show that people who are considered extreme groomers or high-frequency groomers, well, they have sex more often, and they also catch sexually transmitted diseases at a higher rate than the general population. So the study hasn't established a clear cause between pubic hair grooming and sexually transmitted infections, but they know there is a connection, and I just felt compelled to share that with you. I really don't care whether you shave, wax, trim, or just keep your pubic hair all natural. But you deserve to have this information. That's my commitment to you, friends. Thanks for listening to my free daily news and comment podcast. It's available on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again.